Michael Adams, author of Slang, the People's Poetry, argues that we need to look beyond the dictionary's definition of slang, that to truly understand this integral part of American English, we must look at social context, aesthetic value, and its status as a linguistic practice ground. Slang is more than just words. It's a rebellion against the mainstream. It is the forefront of poetry. It is a celebration of language and a rejection of the commonplace. In his book, Slang, the People's Poetry, he looks to present a defense of non-standard English. Michael Adams teaches English language and literature at Indiana University, and it's a great pleasure for him to join us this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. That was the best description of my book that I've ever heard, and I'm glad to hear it so well put.
Well, thank you very much. Give us a sense of how you came to slang and ultimately to defend it.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because I grew up in an English professor's house. And my father was a very prescriptive fellow. He felt there was a right way to talk and a wrong way to talk, and slang didn't figure into it unless it was his own profanity. Then of course, it was useful language. But he tried to keep everybody else from using slang as much as possible. And so for a long time in my life, I didn't really use slang, think of slang much. I'm not a very slangy speaker now, in fact. But about the time I was beginning to work on restaurant jargon, the jargon that servers in restaurants use among themselves, I began to realize that that language, which is a language to smooth the working conditions of restaurant work one way or another, well, it sort of opened my eyes to the fact that slang was related to it and that I ought to be looking at slang phenomena as well as jargon phenomena, right? Out of the workplace and into the real life of real people using real language. And so you know, I started to think about it a little bit and then started to write about it when I saw my first episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and realized there was innovative slang in that show. And that was when I started to collect slang towards a book about the language of that television show. And once I started, you know, really, I couldn't turn back because it's like this infinite sea of human creativity in slang. And if you take your ship out on it, you're likely to be at sea without any horizon in sight for a very long time.
When you say you collect slang, what does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, I suppose it's a lexicographical habit. That is, a lexicographer is one who makes dictionaries to go everywhere with blank cards or a notebook or something like that and write down what you hear or what you see that seems unusual and might add something to our knowledge of words, right? So when I'm sitting in front of the television, I'm often making notes for myself about words that I've never heard before, and sometimes those words are already in dictionaries, and it's my ignorance that we're really recording. But in other cases, you know, I come up with something that is new, you know, that is really emerging in the language, and that tends to be what I write about.
Which brings us to the question that you were answering a moment ago, which is, how do you define slang? What is slang?
Well, slang is a language that turns on language itself. We're all dissatisfied with the language we've got. It doesn't express the things we want to express sometimes. And so that sense of disappointment in the language we have spurs us to some sort of creativity. Maybe we'll turn to standard English, we'll take a term, and we'll turn it on its head so that bad means really great, just as an example that, you know, probably everybody's familiar with. So one aspect of slang, a necessary aspect of it, is that it's critical of the language we use, and a second is that it's creative enough to catch people's attention and to mark someone out as being creative, which is where it's demonstrating an innate human poetic ability. We're all poets if we're using creative language, even if we don't sit down to write a poem in 14 lines, you know, write a sonnet or something like that. We may not be up for the sustained activity of writing poetry, but that doesn't mean that we aren't always producing poetic language.
You just said something that struck me about how we are all dissatisfied with the language in one shape or form. And I've always said that if you want to make the phones ring on a radio program, all you have to do is ask the question, what are your language pet peeves? And you will suddenly be besieged with phone calls from people who basically are complaining about slang. They want a purity of the language.
Yeah, and that's really a different question because, when I say we're dissatisfied with the language we're given, what I mean is that we're prompted to make things work for us because standard English doesn't allow us to say what we want to say. The people who are calling on the phone, you're right, want a purity and want to impose on the creativity of others because they're dissatisfied with that creativity. It's finally, I hate to criticize anybody of that bent who might listen to this, but it's basically a hypocritical position because we're all given to invent or use newly invented things or to push the language just a little bit to get an idea across in conversation. So we're all being a little bit more creative maybe than we're willing to admit, at least more creative than some of those purists are willing to admit. I often note that language pundits who write columns, I'm thinking of William Sapphire, so I'll say the New York Times or John Simon in the Times, people who want to criticize other people's language use themselves as writers are very often creative, and they have a platform for that creativity. Even within a journalistic mode, they get to write things in new and fresh ways and say clever things. Other people may be saying clever things in their slang and have a right to that cleverness just as much as any journalist does. And so I always think it's a little bit odd for people with a creative platform to complain about the creativity of other people. It's like all the creativity has to be yours and not theirs.
How cultural is slang, and does it have an expiration date often?
Some slang has an almost immediate, the sell-by date was before it was created. I mean, it's gone in a second because it's just for that moment when you're talking to someone else and you're, you've got this social relationship with them that you're reinforcing, and you say something that's non-standard, and that makes you, in a way, closer because you're both participating in that. And it also shows the poetic capacity I was talking about a minute ago. And then why would you continue it? Because it was really for that one time, that context. That's the special thing about slang, is that it's not always language that's going to end up in a dictionary because everybody uses it, but it's really just about you and me talking right now. I don't think we should denigrate that. I think that that's very important, social interaction and language use. But then some words really do catch hold. Okay is an example of that. Okay starts out as sort of fabricated slang in newspapers of the late 1830s and gets a boost from the Martin Van Buren presidential campaign because as old Kinderhook, he was often represented by the abbreviations OK. And it's a fascinating story that's too complicated to go into here. But, that was just something that somebody made up and was having fun with in the newspapers. And within a couple of years, it spread across other newspapers. And then people were using it in their everyday conversation. And now it's probably the most worldwide English we've got. It's America's great linguistic export, right? And that comes out of slang. And whether it's slang or not now, probably not. Probably it's become colloquial because we all use it so much that it doesn't have any of that sort of playful aspect to it or the shock value sometimes or that sense of fabrication that marks slang out. But it did it one time, and it's here to stay.
You have a chapter in the book called It's All in Your Head. Give us a sense of slang's role in cognition.
Well, what I say in the book, and I'm happy to say I still believe, is that we've got ways of checking out what we can accomplish with language. Slang is one of those. It's not the only one of them. What I mean by that is you've got to get a grasp of how you can take what you're given linguistically, the language that's in the brain, the system for communicating that you're born with, you've got to figure out how to use that in different contexts of real communication. And so you're always questioning, what can I say with the language? How far can I push the envelope in order to be expressive? When does grammar come in and say, no, you can't go there because then the language doesn't make sense anymore, but you can push it just so much. So slang gives us an opportunity as we're learning to use the language to test the limits of that system, especially in important social contexts. So it's a little bit different from what we do when we're infants and we're beginning to learn how language works, period, right? And we're developing from our brains the grammar of the language we're going to speak. But later on, we've got to figure out how to use language in more socially sophisticated ways, and slang allows us to do that some.
You write an awful lot in the book, and I mentioned it in the introduction, about slang's role in poetry. How did that become, and why is it such an important role?
I'm not sure that slang is in poetry that much, but it's the poetic language that any person can use without sitting down to write a whole poem. So, you know, what happens in poetry is you've got to find out a new way of putting things. There's got to be a freshness to the expression, right? Or nobody really likes the poem that you've written. It's got to be something that catches the ear or takes the eye, and that's what slang does. That's an expression of the poetic impulse we all have. I think it should be very, very reassuring, by the way. I mean, most people, I think, feel like poetry is one thing and what they do in their lives is another thing. They're not really committed to poetry, but actually I think they are, if they're free and easy speakers of English and are using a little bit of slang on occasion. They're being poetic. And when kids are learning about poetry in school, I wish that the textbookness of that would give way to another way of teaching poetry, which is that we're all part way to poetry all of the time in our speech. So there's where I see the relation most significantly, and it's something we should be proud of, because it means that we're all a little bit artistic in the language that we use.
So ultimately, you want a flexibility of the language.
Yes, this is the way I would put it. I think we have to accept that language belongs to its speakers, not to experts who've got rules about how real speakers of a language should speak. I think we have to recognize that the language is owned by its speakers and that they use it brilliantly all of the time, regardless sort of social expectations of how it ought to be used in general context. So I say, yes, let's celebrate what we do with language rather than worrying about whether maybe somebody could speak a little bit more grammatically here or there according to the rules that I presuppose. Just as a side line, a lot of the rules that we have in grammars about how English is spoken are not particularly historically grounded and have a lot to do with people trying to quote-unquote clean up the language so that it can be more expressive of a certain, there's sort of an establishment way of speaking, you know, so that when you're writing and speaking in official ways, you're doing it in a grammatically consistent stylistically clean way. But really, in most contexts in our lives, most of us are speaking a different language from that textbook standard English, and I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of. If you're in a context where you have to speak official English, go ahead and do that. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not to say that official English has to permeate every single bit of our lives, when really we're in control of the language we use, and we use it in fresh and innovative ways because that suits our purposes, and that's okay too.
Michael Adams teaches English language and literature at Indiana University. The name of the book is Slang, the People's Poetry. It is published by Oxford University Press. Michael Adams, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Joe. It was a great pleasure.
A great pleasure on our end as well. Again, the name of the book, Slang, the People's Poetry, published by Oxford. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.